Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Morris and Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana Elbe, and this evening's broadcast will be handling child support, debt collectors, mortgage companies, etc. And what we're going to use today is we have some live feed coming to you, but we're also going to deal with a specific formula in dealing with all of these areas, including the same formula is used and dealing with the police department as well. And but before we get started, let me make mention of the fact that we are offering our free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game. And the way you get that is simply by contacting me, Tahaka Amana Elbe, at Tahaka99 at yahoo.com, and we will get that to you. That's Tahaka99 at yahoo.com. And we'll get that to you. It's TARHAKA99 at yahoo.com. Also, for those of you who are on your social sites, like Dig and MySpace and Black Planet and Twitter and Facebook and the like, if you would send me your friend request, you'll be able to access my wall and the articles and stuff that we post there for your education will be available to you. And so I'm asking if you can send your, if you're on Facebook, or send your friend request to Tahaka Amana Elbe. That's TARHAKA Amana AMAANA, and then L and Bay. And we'll get that to you. Now we're going to be dealing with things like what should you do when contacted by child support enforcement, and when you're contacted by phone by your debt collectors, how do you handle it if you're contacted by mail, mortgage companies attempting to collect it, evict or foreclose on your home. We want to deal with all of that stuff this evening, and we have a ton of information. So if you got paper and pencil handy, it will be to your advantage to write this stuff down. And, of course, you can always go back to and listen to the broadcast if you miss something. On the 19th and 20th of this month, we have Dr. Booker T. Coleman will be here in Jacksonville, Florida, right here at 1625 North Pearl Street. You can get more information on this by visiting www.salammasjid.com. You can call Brother Umar Sharif at area code 904-359-0980 in regards to getting your tickets and what have you and all the information that you need to know about this. The brother's going to be here. We'll have a luncheon for him on the 19th, and then, of course, he'll begin teaching on the 20th. So if you're in town, if you are on the outskirts of town, you really need to be here, and you really need to check this out. It's going to be very, very exciting. Also, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget we have created one of the most comprehensive libraries in the history of the United States. There's tons of information available for you and for your children and for your educational purposes. You can print off what you need if you want to read it right down online. Videos are available to you, audio is available to you. And we also have your estate information in there. For those of you who are trying to access your birth estate, that information is inside that library. And the way you access that is simply by contacting me, Tahaka, at area code 904-303-9061. And I actually do that before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I'll be more than happy to help you with that. Okay? Now, starting out, what we're going to do is we're going to begin dealing with the debt collectors first and how to handle them when they call you, because this is very, very important. They're acting in commerce. You have to understand that. And they're also acting under contract law. The name of the game is to try to build a case to get you to agree to a debt. And but we have a gentleman that's going to come on here in a moment, and he's going to tell you how to deal with that. So we're going to start there first, and we're going to start with three easy steps to stop debt collectors. So I ask you to pay close attention to what this gentleman has to say. Okay?
Hello, this is Lou Ward. Today you're going to discover the three simple secrets that will quickly and easily allow you to stop debt collectors' phone calls forever. You'll also learn how a common gentleman from Florida eliminated $45,000 in credit card debts in 90 days. Follow this procedure if you do not change your phone number, or if you provide your new phone number to the creditors to make it appear as if you have in fact moved to a new residence. This procedure applies to anyone who won't stop calling you, even creditors, even though they may claim not to be liable under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. They are liable under the Telephone Solicitations Act and under the criminal statutes regarding harassing and threatening telephone communications. Step 1. Never discuss the account. The first lesson in responding to unwanted calls from creditors or debt collectors is that you must never discuss the account that you are calling about. Step 2. Your first concern is to obtain the caller's full name, mailing address, and phone number. Step 3. Keep a phone log. Write this down in a log next to your phone along with the time and date. Step 4. Don't give out any information. Never give out any information about yourself to the caller, not your address, phone number, banking information, social security number, driver's license number, nothing. Do not acknowledge the accuracy or inaccuracy of any information they provide. If they do not have it, they do not need it, and it's their problem. You may need to confirm that they have the right person in order to complete the next steps, but give them nothing else. Remember that what you say will be summarized or quoted in their call management software database. Follow these steps, and you can use this to your advantage. Step 5. His right to remain silent. Inform the caller that a conversation is being recorded, that he has the right to remain silent, and that anything he says may be used against him in a court of law. Expect him to end the call at that point, but be prepared to continue to explain that you do not want to receive any more calls from this organization and that any further calls would constitute harassment and a Class 1 misdemeanor under the state law. Step 6. His personal responsibility. Explain that if anyone calls you again from this organization, that you will hold him personally responsible and file a written complaint for telephone harassment against him individually with the State Attorney General's office. Step 7. Inform the caller that you are requesting a validation of the disputed account. Never indicate that you refuse to pay. And again, do not disclose anything specific about the account. Step 8. Request their Do Not Call policy. Request a copy of their Do Not Call policy as required by the Federal Telephone Solicitations Act. Step 9. Send request for validation. send the collector the request for validation as explained in the next coming videos, and the notice to stop telephone communications as shown also in the next following videos. Final step. Again, do not give out any information. This procedure is absolutely effective at stopping about 99% of all unwanted phone calls without the regard of the matter about which they are calling. Now, to get more videos and information, plus the secret 2 and 3, the $45,000 debt-to-cash report, the quick fix credit repair, go to the following link below. That's www.debtrelief911.com. There you'll learn more about eliminating credit card debts in 90 days without settlement or debt consolidation. Thank you and have a great day.
Okay, Morris. That was some very, very valuable information, and it's actually pretty simple. What they're attempting to do is to get you, number one, to agree to be the straw man. Okay, that's step one. Step two, they're trying to get you to agree that there is an existing debt that's attached to the straw man, mind you, but you are going to acknowledge that you are responsible for. You see how that works? And yet, keep in mind that this is a game. It's all in commerce. It doesn't have anything to do with a crime. But you must understand that each time they contact you, they are building a case against you. They are able to go in a courtroom and say, well, we contacted him here. He agreed that he owed us this, that, and the other. And so what you have to do is turn it around. Remember in previous broadcasts, we talked about contract law. You go ahead and accept their offer, and you're in a counter offer and let them know how much you're going to be charging them for the infractions that they're attempting to do. First of all, they're attempting to attach you to something that's not you. That constitutes fraud, and then those who are backing them up makes it a conspiracy, because this type of thing is going on all over the United States, and we're going to have to do something to stop it. And the way to stop it is becoming knowledgeable, because the more knowledge you have, the more confident you are, the more power you have, the more power you have at your disposal to act upon. So don't hesitate to call me in regards to your library. You contact me, Tahaga, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Get this thing. That way you got a steady base inside right there at your fingertips that you can study on a daily basis. There's tons of information in there. There's information on contract law. There's information on law, period. There's information on sovereignty, government, you name it. It's there and available for you. So the more you study these material, the more confident you are, and the more you are able to act upon what you know. And I mean, it's just common sense, because you can only regurgitate what's in the brain computer. And if you got the information in there, you just roll off the top of your head. But you have to study. You have to have access to this material. So just contact me, Tahaka Mana El Bay, at area code 904-303-9061. Okay? And we'll get that to you.
Hello, and welcome back to another powerful credit repair tip. Today, we're going to talk about one of the most important things that a lot of people ask me questions about, and that's how to stop a collection agency in their tracks. Now, this is one that's going to be really good, so don't get up, don't go get a soda, don't answer your cell phone, don't anything. Because I don't want you to miss any part of this. Okay, now, it's two ways that you can handle a collection agency. One, you can handle them by the mail. That's when they send you a collection letter. Two, you can handle them over the phone. And that's when they are constantly calling your house every other minute. And I know there's some of you out there that have experienced that, because I have experienced that and even more. Okay, but let me ask you a few questions first now. If you decide that you are going to pay this bill that they claim that you owe and that they are harassing you about on a daily basis, then we're going to talk about how to settle that bill for pennies on a dollar in another video. Okay? Now, if you are tired of them harassing you, calling your phone every single day, and if you are tired of them leaving these crazy messages and threatening you to do this or do that, and if you are tired of receiving these collection letters on a daily basis, then the techniques and strategies that I'm going to teach right now, right here, then you will use those to apply to the harassment. Now, these techniques and these strategies that I'm talking to you about come straight from my book, Hidden Credit Repair Secrets. Okay, now, let's talk about the first method of how collection agencies harass you. Well, have you ever received that letter in the mail that states that this is a collection agency attempting to collect a debt and that you owe this particular money and you need to respond within 30 days? If you decide that, in fact, that is not your bill, or for whatever reason you can't pay it and you want them to stop sending you that letter, according to the Fair Debt Credit Practicing Act, that is a law that regulates the collection agencies, you know, keep them in check. According to that law, if you write the collection agency and you tell them that you do not want them to further contact you, the collection agency by law must stop contacting you by mail and by phone. Now, what you do is you write a letter and you simply tell them, do not call my house again and do not send me another letter. Make sure you send it certified mail with return receipt. I guarantee you, if you send it certified mail, return receipt, the collection agency will not contact you again. Why? Because they know that you have proof that you have sent this letter. Okay? Now, the law states that the collection agency can contact you one more time. This last time that they contact you, they can send a letter, and in that letter, it will tell you what they're going to do next, on whether they're going to send this collection account back to the creditor or if they're going to pursue legal actions. So that's step one. Now, step two is the biggie. And most people experience this the most. This is the phone calls. This is the threatening you over the phone. This is leaving these crazy messages on the phone. Now, you can stop that very instantly, and I'm going to show you exactly how you do it. Now, if a collection agency calls you, now I'm going to act like the collection agency, and I'm going to act like the consumer, okay? Once you see how I handle this situation, if you apply these same strategies and techniques, then I guarantee you, you'll stop them. Okay? Now, I'm the collection agency. My phone rings. Bing, bing, bing. Hello? Yes, this is ABC John from collection agency Roger. Is Mr. Claiborne there? Yeah, this is Mr. Claiborne. How can I help you, sir? Well, I would like to let you know that I'm calling you in attempt to collect a debt, but before I do that, I need to verify some information. Okay, well, what information do you need to verify? I need to verify your name, your date of birth, your address, and your employer. Freeze. Let's stop right there. Now, most people, because they're scared, they will go ahead and give this information to the collector. Now, if you're trying to settle your debt, then yes, it's probably best to give this information to your collector if you're going to pay it. Okay, but if you want him to stop calling you and harassing you, never, ever admit that you owe the debt. and never, ever give them your work address or your work phone number. Why? Because if you don't pay this debt, what are they going to do? They're going to sue you in small claims court. They're going to get a judgment by default because most people don't even show up. And then they're going to attack your wages. Very easy for them. So never disclose where you work. If they ask you where you work, you tell them that's not important. Okay? Remember, if they ask you where you work, you tell them that's not important. Why do you need to know that? That's not important. You already have my information. Okay. If you want to stop them from calling you on a regular basis, here's how you handle that call. You ready? Here we go. Hello? Yes, this is collection agency so-and-so calling for Mark Claiborne. Is this Mark? Yes, this is Mark. How can I help you, sir? Yes, this is John, and I'm calling about account 7778. How do you want to deal with this debt? Sir, do me a favor. If you want to communicate with me, I need you to send everything to me in writing. You have my information. Do it. And don't call me again. Bye. Very easy to do, right? You have instructed this guy to don't call you or never call you again. According to the law, all you have to do is tell the creditor or the collection agency that you do not want them to call you again and to send any correspondence by mail. Now, some collection agencies, they're tricky and they're slick. They won't give you their real name. They won't give you their telephone. They won't give you the address. If they won't give you this information, then hang up on them. There's no need for you to be on the phone with them, okay? And the only reason why they won't give you this information because they know you may send them a letter stating to stop calling them, okay? Now, once you tell them to stop calling you, you follow up with the same letter stating the same thing, certified mail, return receipt, stop calling me. Let me repeat, never admit that you owe the debt, never give out your work history, and if you don't want to talk to them, you tell them to stop calling you, they are harassing you, and you understand your rights in the law, and then hang up on them, okay? Now, here is a bonus. Now, I wasn't supposed to give this to you guys, but I'm going to give you to this because this works very effectively. If a collection agency calls you, right, and they start talking, before they even start, you cut them off and you say, sir, this conversation has been recorded for quality control. Watch them hang up on you. Again, that was another powerful credit repair secret. This is Mark. I'm the author of Hidden Credit Repair Secrets. Now, I'm going to put up this powerful letter on how to stop collection agencies in their tracks. I'm going to put it up on my fan page. Okay, so you have to go and become a fan in order to get this letter, in order to download this powerful letter. This one letter alone will stop the collection agencies in their tracks. But the only way you can get it is by becoming a fan, and you should be able to download it from my fan page. Also, if you join my mailing list, you'll get a chance to read the first chapter of Hidden Credit Repair Secrets for free, and you will get a Restore Your Credit e-class, very, very powerful class. I'm giving all these gifts away for free. All you have to do is become a fan and join my mailing list. Stay tuned for more powerful credit repair secrets. Take care.
Okay, Moores, I think that's some very, very important information, and I want you to pay close attention to something. Now, notice that the information that I've been providing for you in the past two or three broadcasts, 2 hour segments, hour segments. We have not been talking about filing any documents, no UCC one codes, no putting in a change of address, and paying nobody no hundreds and thousands of dollars to do no documents for you. We're trying to stop you from doing that, and that's why I'm providing this information. And as we proceed through this broadcast, I want you to notice how consistent this is. We're going to have some more people that's going to come in there, and they're going to tell you, write a letter. You know, it's just that simple. It don't cost you nothing but a few pennies to do that. But we got people out there that's got people jumping through all these hoops and stuff. That is totally unnecessary. Once you have access to knowledge, then you're able to do all kind of things. I mean, you know, dealing with your mortgage company, dealing with the police, I've done this stuff pretty much off the top of my head. Now, when it came to the mortgage company, I took some documents and stuff that I created, and I forwarded it to them for a specific purpose. Now, that was my strategy based on the knowledge that I had. But, you know, each circumstance can be different once you understand the rules of the game. See, this is a game that they're playing. See, we already know that the United States is not a country. It is a corporation. It acts in commerce. There's only debtors and creditors. The whole system is designed to accommodate debtors and creditors. Either you are a debtor or you are a creditor. It doesn't have anything to do with your color. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that you may be a male or, on the other hand, you may be a female. None of that. But you understand the rules of the game, then you can play the game. So this is why we put the rules of the game inside the Tahoga Library, so you have all the rules and all the marbles right there so you can play the game. You access that by simply contacting me at area code 904-303-9061 and go ahead and get the power that you need to play the game. Now, we're going to the next segment, ladies and gentlemen. And this is a very, very powerful segment. I want you to pay close attention to this. This is very, very important information that these people are going to give you here. Very important information. So pay close attention to that. And don't forget to send me your a request for the free article, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game. Let me get that to you, because once you understand that, once you read that and understand that, then you say, well, oh, man, it's, you know, okay, you know, I can play this game, and I can win at it. I'll be good at it, okay? And, you know, a lot of stuff and hoops and stuff that people jumping through, you won't have to do that because you have a power base. And so we got this stuff laid out for you. We got tons of information, printed information. You can run off copies. We got it video format. We got audio format. We cover all the bases of life for you that you can deal with. Okay? All right. So we're going to continue on with this thing. Next segment.
Welcome back to the Most News in the Morning. As job cuts and the housing crisis catch more and more homeowners in the crossfire, mortgages and defaults are skyrocketing. But one congresswoman says she's sick of bailouts for Wall Street and nothing for the folks who might soon be living on Main Street. She's telling her constituents to become squatters in their own homes. Drew Griffin has the story.
The notices came to her home in April. Andrea Geis's bank foreclosed on her. Behind in payments, out of work, a husband sick, she had nowhere to go. So she decided to follow the advice of her congresswoman and go nowhere. Geis is part of a new movement in the housing crisis, squatters.
For lack of a better term, you're kind of squatting in this house, aren't you?
Basically, yes.
More than 4,000 properties were foreclosed on in Toledo's Lucas County last year. This year, it could be worse. Elected officials are saying Toledo is not in a recession, it is a depression. It is this bleak backdrop that inspired Toledo Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur to take the floor of the House earlier this month to tell her constituents to stay put.
So I say to the American people, you'll be squatters in your own homes. Don't you leave.
Kaptur says she has had it with government bailouts for Wall Street banks, but nothing for homeowners. She is advocating for a legal revolution, a demand that not one of her constituents leaves their home without an attorney and a fight.
Even if they've been foreclosed on, don't leave.
If they've had no legal representation of a high quality, I tell them stay in their homes.
Kaptur is behind a strategy called Produce the Note. Mortgages have been so divvied up on Wall Street that banks are having a hard time finding that original paperwork, adding a delay to foreclosures. She is also pushing banks to rework loans, especially those banks getting bailouts and holding mortgages of folks getting tossed out.
They're vultures. They prey on our property assets. And I guess the reason I'm so adamant on this is because I know property law and its power to protect the individual homeowner. And I believe that 99.9% of our people have not had good legal representation in this.
Without a lawyer, Andrea Geis bought a $147,000 home with nearly $40,000 down.
I should have had an attorney. I really should have had the attorney. I did not know.
She admits she didn't read the paperwork, didn't learn, until it was too late. She had a subprime loan. Her payments of $883 a month jumped in a year to more than $1,500. When it did, she stopped paying.
So they foreclosed on me.
They have foreclosed on me.
So what do the banks say? Well, the law firm representing the bank in Geis's foreclosure declined comment. Another one of the banks Geis believes holds her note, Wells Fargo, Kieran, said it wouldn't comment on individual cases, but tries to work with homeowners. Well, now that homeowner, backed by her congressman, Kieran, is simply not budging.
It is, and it's a situation that we see replayed all over the country. The other thing is people say they have been having trouble as they try to reach out, make contact, and figure out if there's some way to rework their loans.
Yeah, in many cases, you just can't talk to the person. You get in these phone trees, or you're dealing with brokers who are working for the loans. It's very, very difficult to get through the red tape.
Wow, very interesting stuff. We'll see if the congresswoman gets other support from her colleagues as well. Drew Griffin, thanks so much. Okay, Morris. Now, let's go back and recap on what we understand in regards to the debt collectors and the mortgage people as well. They're all the same. They're all trying to collect the debt that you agreed to be a part of. However, you must keep in mind that they can only deal with a straw man. And so if you go back, those of you who are homeowners and get your, those of you who receive something from bill collectors, get the information and take a look at it and see if how they got your spell. If you got you in all capital letters, okay, you're dealing with a straw man. So any third grade English teacher will just tell you simply that simply can't be attached to a living, breathing being. That's only attached to anything other than a living, breathing being. Now, those of you who are working on your estate, you've already gotten your library, you're crafting your
estate letter. Okay, now, this is a very, very good move. I like to recommend that you do this when dealing with your debt collectors and stuff. Go ahead now that you got your letters and stuff in place. You've accessed your birth account. You're now officially, automatically a creditor. The estate is the bank. The court. It carries the power of overriding the court. So when you sign, you are now officially signing as John Doe Estate. No longer John Doe, but John Doe Estate. And just leave it at that. Do not go into any explanation of the fact that you are now officially the executor of an existing multi-million dollar estate. Don't do that. Just simply sign it as an estate and be consistent in that. And you have to keep in mind that when they send you something through the mail, go ahead and examine it very closely. If you see them capital letters anywhere, they ain't talking to you. So what they're attempting to do is attach something to you via straw man. So go ahead on and craft you a little letter up and say, well, look, there seems to be a slight clerical error, and make sure you make a copy of that. And but we need to, if you can correct your records, if my understanding serves me correctly, and I learned in third grade grammar that a noun is the name of a person, place, or thing, or idea, provided it's spelled correctly. If it's in an upper and lowercase letter, does that indicate a proper noun? If it is in all capital letters, as it appears on the letter that you sent me, that indicates anything other than a living, breathing being. So I have to assume that this is some type of action on your part to extort revenue. But never mention anything about the debt. Go ahead and sign it, John Doe Estate. Make copies of it. And I'll keep it in your files and wait on the next one. Okay, go ahead and send them a copy of that. And just like the gentleman said with the return receipt, you can send a first-class mail. When you get to the post office, you can say we need tracking information on that and so on and so forth. But anyway, the name of the game is to go ahead and build you a little case, too, from your position. And it is a good idea if you replay this broadcast and extract this information till you get it down to a science. We have not added it to the library as yet, but we will be adding it shortly. And so for those of you who have the library already, just go ahead and hold tight. We'll be putting it up in there. But right now we're firing this cannon, and we want all the brothers and the sisters to see what's out there, the remedies that you have at your disposal so you can stop these people from rolling you. Now, I got a call from a young man the other day. He was up in the Northern Territory, and the brother's been doing very, very well, and he told me, and I can tell that he has really, really learned a lot from listening to these broadcasts and doing his research. He said the police stopped him. He's on a motorcycle, no driver's license, no tag whatsoever. So when the police come up to the car, he asked him to show him his driver's license and registration, and the brother said, well, first of all, I don't have a driver's license, but before we get started with any of this, I'm going to need some form of ID from you. Do you have an identification card? Do you have a business card? Or can you provide me with something tangible as evidence to the fact that you're saying you are who you are? And the officer responded with, well, I'm in uniform. I have a badge. I have a car. And the brother responded, well, you know, you could pick that up right out there in Hollywood somewhere. You know, I mean, because we do have people who are going around robbing people, impersonating police officers. For your protection, it is recommended that you always ask these people for identification. Now, if they're refusing to give you identification, the brother told me the next step that he did was that he contacted, dialed 911 and contacted the dispatch operator. And he informed the officers that he could go ahead and get his watch commander to come on down, and so he can get some verification on who the officer was before they went any further with the straw man business. And he had a hard time trying to get the dispatch operator to give him any information on the officer. Once she found out that it was a policeman that was stopping him, she was trying to protect the police officer. So what the brother did next is he called the FBI, okay? And by that time, here comes the commander. And the commander asked me, say, what's the problem? He said, I don't have a problem.
He says, you have a driver's license? No, I don't have a driver's license. Who are you talking to on the phone? He says, I'm talking to the FBI. And, of course, he knew right then that we got a serious problem because this brother, he could shake the firm. So he told him to go ahead on and hang up the phone, crank up his motorcycle, and go on about his business. See, when you understand the game and the rules of the game, then you can play the game successfully. In order to play the game successfully, you're going to need some power. You don't have to jump through all these hoops. You can go down there, you're putting in a change of address and giving somebody $100 for that and signing an archetype and paying these people here $250 over here to nationalize you and filing the UCC-1 and sending this document here and that document there, and you're out of $2,000 and ain't accomplished nothing because most of the documents that you're sending, you don't even know anything about them. So let's go a whole different route and do this thing totally differently, and then we'll discover that we have much more success when we just simply learn the rules of the game. And the rules of the game is right there in Tahoga's library. Just contact me at area code 904-303-9061, and we will get you in there. The only thing that I ask is just contact before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I would certainly appreciate it. We got brothers as far as outside the United States. I've been contacted as far as Afghanistan, Japan, the United Kingdom, all over the earth. In regards to the information that we're putting out here for the aid and help of my people, okay? So just stay tuned into these broadcasts, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that you have what you need.
If there was a question about whether we're headed for a second housing shock, that was settled last week with news that home prices have fallen a sixth consecutive month. Values are down nearly to the levels of the Great Recession. One thing weighing on the economy is the huge number of foreclosed houses. Many are stuck on the market for a reason that you wouldn't expect. Banks can't find the ownership documents. It's bizarre, but it turns out that Wall Street cut corners when it created those mortgage-backed investments that triggered the financial collapse. Now that banks want to evict people, they're unwinding these exotic investments to find that often the legal documents behind the mortgages aren't there. Caught in a jam of their own making, some companies appear to be resorting to forgery and phony paperwork to throw people down on their luck out of their homes. In the 1930s, we had breadlines. Venture out before dawn in America today, and you'll find mortgage lines. These folks on the street aren't homeless. They slept on the sidewalk because they want to keep their homes. Facing foreclosure, they camped out in January to get in line to beg their bank for lower payments on their mortgage. So many in the country are desperate now that they have to meet in convention centers coast to coast.
We understand people have been here for a day or two.
Two and a half.
This was Los Angeles, where 37,000 homeowners gathered. And this was Miami in February, where the worry was visible and shared by 12,000 more. The line went down the block and doubled back twice. Dale DeFritis lost her job. Now she fears her home is next.
It's very emotional because I just think about it. I don't want to lose my home. I really don't.
It's your American dream.
It was. And it still is.
Welcome to Dr. Save the Dream. Welcome, everybody.
These convention center events are put on by the nonprofit Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, which helps people figure out what they can afford and then walks them across the hall to bank representatives to ask for lower payments. More than half will get their mortgages adjusted, but the rest discover that they just can't keep their home. And for many, that's when the real surprise comes in. Turns out these banks, which demand borrowers have all of their paperwork just right, these same banks have fouled up their own paperwork to a historic degree.
In my mind, this is an absolute intentional fraud.
Lynn Simoniak is fighting foreclosure, and while trying to save her house, she discovered something we did not know. back when Wall Street was using algorithms and computers to engineer those disastrous mortgage-backed securities, it appears they didn't want old-fashioned paperwork slowing down the profits.
This is back when it was a white-hot, fevered pitch to move as many of these as possible.
When you could make a whole lot of money through securitization, and every other aspect of it could be done electronically, you know, keystrokes. This was the only piece where somebody was supposed to actually go get documents, transfer the documents from one entity to the other. And it looks very much like they just eliminated that step altogether.
Simoniac's mortgage had been bundled with thousands of others into one of those Wall Street securities traded from investor to investor. When the bank took Simoniac to court, it first said that it had lost her documents, including the critical assignment of mortgage, which transfers ownership. But then there was a courthouse surprise.
They found all of your paperwork more than a year after they initially said that they had lost it.
Yes.
Did that seem suspicious to you?
Yes, absolutely. What do you imagine? It fell behind the file cabinet? Where was all of this? We had it. We own it. We lost it. And then more recently, everyone is coming in saying, hey, we found it. Isn't that wonderful?
But what the bank may not have known is Lynn Simoniac is a lawyer and fraud investigator with a specialty in forged documents. She has trained FBI agents.
Did you ask for copies of those documents?
Yes.
And what did you find?
When I looked at the assignment of mortgage, and this is the assignment, a copy from my case, I looked at even the date they put in, which was 10/17/2008, was several months after they sued me for foreclosure. So what they were saying to the court was, we sued her in July of 2008, and we acquired this mortgage in October of 2008. It made absolutely no sense.
Curious, she used her legal training to go online and researched 10,000 mortgages.
Then I began to find the strange signatures.
One of the strangest signatures belonged to the bank vice president who'd signed Simoniac's newly discovered mortgage documents. The name is Linda Green. But on thousands of other mortgages, the style of Green's signature changed a lot, and even more remarkable, Simoniac found that Linda Green was vice president of 20 banks, all at the same time.
All within the same week. I mean, this is a very, very active person. And you can
Where did all those documents come from? We went searching for the Linda Green, and we found her in rural Georgia. She told us she's never been a bank vice president. In 2003, she was a shipping clerk for auto parts. When her grandson told her about a job at a company called Docs, D-O-C-X. Docs, once housed here in Alpharetta, Georgia, was a sweatshop for forged mortgage documents.
They were sitting in a room signing their name as fast as they possibly could to any kind of nonsense document that was put in front of them.
Docs and companies like it were recreating missing mortgage assignments for the banks and providing the legally required signatures of bank vice presidents and notaries. Linda Green says she was named a bank vice president by Docs because her name was short and easy to spell. As demand exploded, Docs needed more Linda Greens.
So you're Linda Green?
Yes. Can't you tell?
Chris Pendley worked at Docs at the same time and signed as Linda Green.
When you came in to Docs on your first day, what did they tell you your job was going to be?
That I was going to be signing documents for using someone else's name.
Did you think there was something strange about that in the beginning?
Yeah, it seemed a little strange, but they told us and they repeatedly told us that everything was above board and it was legal.
And your previous experience in banking?
None.
In legal documents?
None.
There really were no requirements for the job.
Correct.
You had to be able to hold a pen.
Hold a pen.
But you were signing these documents as if you were an officer of the bank.
Correct.
How many banks were you vice president of in a given day?
I would guess somewhere around 5 to 6.
What were you getting paid for this?
I'm embarrassed to say. $10 an hour.
$10 an hour. That's not much for a guy who's vice president of 5 banks.
Yeah, I was very underpaid for my status in the companies.
Pendley showed us how he signed mortgage documents as Linda Green.
He told us that Doc's employees had to sign at least $350 an hour. Findlay estimates that he alone did $4,000 a day. This is also Linda Green. Shawana Kreit worked at Doc's and says that she both signed and notarized the mortgage documents.
What was the role of the notary?
We were to make sure that everyone on the document was who they said they were and notarized the documents.
But the people who were signing the documents weren't who they said they were.
Right.
So if Chris Pendley was signing for Linda Green, you'd notarize that document.
Yes.
And you were told that was okay.
Yes.
What do you know now?
That it wasn't right.
The real Linda Green didn't want to be interviewed, but she said that some of the bank vice presidents at Doc's were high school kids. Their signatures were entered into evidence in untold thousands of foreclosure suits that sent families packing.
So it was a common practice in the last few years to flood the courts with these documents.
And look at some of the junk the courts were flooded with. Sometimes the document mill didn't even bother to fill in the name of the supposed owners. To them, it seemed like a joke.
Instead of the name of the bank here that was acquiring the loan, this one says bogus assignee for intervening assignments. That's who acquired this loan.
This was an actual document that was in litigation?
Yes. And what corporation assigned this loan? A corporation identified as a bad beanie. Excuse me, when I saw that, I was just absolutely amazed.
What does that mean, a bad beanie?
It could possibly mean a bad beneficiary. I have no idea what they meant. So here's the same woman, Linda Green, and this time, instead of being a vice president of American Home Mortgage Servicing, she's vice president of a bad beanie.
Simoniak says that the banks, whose paperwork was handled by the Doc's forgery mill, included Wells Fargo, HSBC, Deutsche Bank, Citibank, U.S. Bank, and Bank of America. We contacted all of them, and each said that it farmed out its mortgage servicing work to other companies, and it was those mortgage servicing firms that hired Doc's. Doc's was owned by a company called LPS, a $2 billion firm that calls itself the nation's leading provider of mortgage processing services. LPS told us that when it found out about the phony signatures in 2009, it shut Doc's down. The FBI and several states are investigating. There were a million foreclosures last year, and there will be another million this year. Those lawsuits are forcing open those bundled mortgage-backed securities that Wall Street cooked up in the mid-2000s, and they're exposing a lack of ownership documents all across the country.
It's astonishing to me that this became as pervasive as a problem that it is.
It got sloppy.
It got very sloppy.
Sheila Bair is one of the government's top banking regulators as chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
You just described it as pervasive.
Yeah, it is pervasive. It absolutely is pervasive. And it was just a matter of cutting corners, not spending enough money, not having any quality control.
Incompetent banking back then is causing foreclosure ghettos today. Although banks say the courts have been accepting their paperwork, now that's changing as desperate homeowners countersue the banks over the document fiasco. This leaves houses unsold indefinitely, undermining the recovery.
I'm very worried about if this starts getting out of hand, the kind of impact it will have.
These are lawsuits by homeowners.
Yes.
Who are being foreclosed upon, saying,
yes, or are in the process or have already been foreclosed on.
Saying
it.
Prove it.
Yes, exactly.
Prove that you own this.
Exactly.
How big an issue is that going to be? There are 30,000 today.
I think this litigation could easily get out of control, and we would like to get ahead of it. We're already feeling like we're falling behind it.
Chairman Bair thinks rotten mortgage documents are so threatening to the economy that the government should force banks to pay into a massive fund.
But you think there needs to be a cleanup fund?
I do.
Just
it's
like
cleanup,
you would have
a good word for it, yeah.
For a natural disaster.
Yes, yeah, somewhat like that. Yes, this is one of human making, but yes.
You don't want to give an exact dollar amount for this cleanup fund, but what are we talking about? Is it billions?
Yes, I would assume it would be billions, yeah.
Billions of dollars.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Chairman Bair's proposed cleanup fund would pay homeowners to accept a bank's ownership claim without a lawsuit.
She says that this could be cheaper for the banks than trying to recreate the missing documents legitimately and not through the document mills.
I think eventually the bank could prove who owned it, but it would take a lot of time and expense.
You know, none of the major banks were willing to sit down with us and talk to us about this, not even the American Bankers Association.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Why do you think that is?
They're feeling very defensive now, and so I can only assume that is the reason why they declined.
The banks are defensive because all 50 state attorneys general want to punish them. The states are seeking about $20 billion in damages for what they say is the irresponsible, perhaps criminal way that some mortgage companies handled what is, for most folks, the most important investment of their lives. Do you know who really owns your mortgage? To learn more, go to 60MinutesOvertime.com. Sponsored by Lipitor.
Okay. That was a bombshell. And for those of you who have your mortgages and stuff, you can go on it back in that draw where you first put it at 10 or 12 years ago. It's still there. And take it out and start looking at it, examining it. But now, remember what they said. Even if the bank did go back and get the original mortgage, remember what I told you about commerce contract law and the straw man. Examine it. Look at the printed materials and see how they got it filled out. If by some hook or crook, some faraway chance, they got it, your name spelled in upper and lower case letters, no problem. Brothers and sisters who have my library to put your letters in, the estate letter, drop that bomb on them. Ladies and gentlemen, we got a caller on the line. I'm going to open up the line before we go into the next segment. And now see what the brothers and sisters are talking about.
Islam.
Area code 773. Islam, brother. Who am I speaking to,
Islam,
and where you calling from?
This is Sheikh Love Hill calling from Moore's Mecca, also known as Chicago, Illinois. And I just want to say all praise due to Allah, the Lord, cherish the government, sustain the ruler of the world. And I just want to extend hail and high honors to all the eels and days out there. I'm a foreclosure specialist. That's what I do for a living. just to give a little background on myself, how I got involved in this is actually becoming a member of the Moorish Science Temple of America back in 1994 and researching some documentation that was left by the prophet. That specific documentation is document 1010-5905, which represents our authority, among other things. So upon discovering this documentation that was not really being pumped up so much in the temples at the time, when I joined, it was back in 94, P. David Seal was the Grand Sheik at the time. So a lot of those things I had brought up when I was in those meetings and those settings, so why are we not utilizing the power and authority of the prophet to get real estate? The Religious Corporation Act, which is referenced on our authority, made a reference to burial ground, camping ground, schools, things of that nature. So these challenges was being put forth to the temple even back to 20, before 2000 came on the scene. So when I recognized that the leadership there was deficient in explaining those things and understanding, which wasn't necessarily their fault, but it is what it is. I knew then I had to go on a journey to find out how this thing was working. So that's what led me on the journey to get a real estate license, which I did in 2001, because mm-hmm. I figured, well, I need to understand how this thing is working, how these properties are being transferred from one person to another.
Mm-hmm.
And true enough, when I did my research going down to the recorded deeds office, I saw that it was just a game. They were just flipping properties back and forth, one person's name to another. And it looked to me like, wow, this is really something. Because, see, what occurred is me and my brother, we just went head on and we just took a chance. We saw they had the fast track property listed in the newspaper at the time. This is back in 1999, 2000. So we took it upon ourselves to go ahead and just take over those properties. And what we found out is that that's what we begin to find out about the authority, really, get in depth. Yes, sir.
Okay.
So at that point in time, that led me on the team to really pretty much get a better, a more greater understanding of real estate law and how the sales piece worked and everything. It really opened up my eyes to things that was going on, how the banks was pretty much taking over these properties, and then these properties were not getting any better. They would just change the names of the owners, and it's the same situation. So that's what led me to begin to get an understanding, a greater understanding of real estate without being hampered down by the system, per se, because I had been led into it through my research in the temple in the first place. And also understanding that the Prophet Noble Jalali talked about economic security and saying that economic security needs to be preached more than anything else. He talked about creating better jobs for the boys and girls. He talked about putting ourselves out there in the affairs of men. So all these things had to be demonstrated. So when I realized that that's what I need to do, that's when I started moving in that order and moving in that fashion. But that led to me doing even more research to find out that that real estate, anytime anybody purchases real estate, you're not purchasing the real estate. It's not even in your name. You never really, you only see what it is we're fooled under the illusion because we have access to the, what is known as the bundle of rights that we have ownership. But nothing can be further from the truth. I mean, you can still have access to the bundle of rights and be renting the property out. So it's almost as if you're the owner. You're doing the things that an owner would do, but you're still not the owner. And how do we know this? Even if you paid off your mortgage, let's say you did, there's still a requirement to pay taxes. And oftentimes the taxes can be as much as your mortgage payment used to be. So
exactly.
What we found out is that it's true and what the prophet was saying as far as knowing thyself and thy father God Allah, but from a business perspective, learn to understand what that all entails and what that's about is what led us into getting an even better understanding of how we're supposed to demonstrate. For example, there's a speech that's called Think This Over You More, and the prophet spoke about how to acquire real estate. And by the mere fact, well, this is what he said, and I'm not saying it verbatim necessarily, but he said that any time a member desires to make a purchase, to notify the prophet or the temple so that he knows what's on him. And he also make a reference to members not the leadership not borrowing more than $10 from the members. And he also said, and this is the key thing right here, he made a reference to the temple, that property. He said anytime property is purchased, it should be purchased under the name of the temple or himself, Noble Jalali or the Moorish Science Temple of America. Within this, we see the various, we see the aspects of trust law and how the prophet was actually putting it out there for us to protect ourselves and our assets. So there was a process in place for the purchase of property. And we know this because when you do the history on Moorish, when you do Moorish American history, you'll see that there were Moors in the neighborhoods in droves. There were so many Moors that we were able to have costumed parades. So then that stands the reason that there was a lot of home ownership back during that time. Okay, so that's, but the key thing is it was the way that it was done. And this, and we also see glimmers and shades of this in the Nation of Islam, as far as with Elijah Muhammad being a former member, as Robert Poole Bay, he incorporated a lot of what he had learned from the Prophet into the Nation of Islam as far as the economics is concerned and as far as how to deal with the real estate piece. Now, I've heard about debates about old buildings being resecured, and it's all these squabbles about who's the real leader, who's the supreme grand sheik. Well, the one that's going to really be demonstrating is the one that's going to do what the prophet said, and the one that's going to follow closely, as close to the model as possible. And that's demonstrating that economic security, that economic peace. That's why I want to give honors to the brother for providing such a platform, because this is encouragement. We need to have this. We need to understand that there are ways for us to save ourselves and our communities just by being innovative and doing what the prophet said. Think so that you can save yourself. He said, if I can get you to think, then you can save yourself. And this is just one aspect of this, dealing with the foreclosure issues and the mortgage issues. It's just like the brother was saying, if you just take the time out to read through some of that documentation. I'll give you an example. There's a in any particular mortgage document, section 22. Look at that section. There it speaks about there's an acceleration clause. And this is something that they violate probably each and every time they attempt to close on someone. They have to notify the borrower of the if there's any acceleration before they actually initiate the foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
So this is part of what we've been seeing, and that paperwork in the courts in a certain way, then you'll see that it has a certain effect. Now, we have we had a situation that occurred here in Lake County. This is near Cook County, where we had a foreclosure case. This is from beginning to the end. That means that my clients came to me initially because the mortgage payments were too high. So I advised them to stop making the payments, and they did. But what we did was we sent the lender, which is Bank of America, what was known as a qualified written request. And this is in the form of a rescission letter. Now, this letter is designed, and here we go with the letters again. The letter was designed to pretty much give the lender the opportunity to explain how all the documents were put together and if they, in fact, violated the law with the way they put together the documentation and put together the package. It pretty much calls to question everything on the HUD statement, the settlement statement. So that document that the brother spoke about, going over all those documents, pulling them out the drawer after all those years, yeah, those same documents. We call the lender out on that. Asked him to please explain this, please explain that.
There you go.
In this case, the lenders, their response was to just initiate foreclosure. Okay, mm-hmm. So we started that in June, and then fast forward up to September 22nd of 2011, they began to initiate the foreclosure. Bank of America, now Bank of America's lenders countrywide. So anybody that's been involved with foreclosure or in the market or know anything about that, Bank of America should be, you should know that they're a pretty big player in this whole thing. So at any rate, we initiate that paper. They initiated foreclosure. And as soon as my clients brought that to me, we began to put together the paperwork. The motion to dismiss in the form of an affirmative defense, a motion to dismiss the plaintiff to foreclose on a mortgage in the form of an affirmative defense. We put together a memorandum in support of that motion to dismiss, and we also put together a motion for discovery, which pretty much, when they got that information and we put it all together, we had to some back and forth at first because it went on until about, I would say, March the 7th of this year. When we had the package together, we had the power of attorney, we had all the motions that I just mentioned, we had the appearance forms, we even put in the forms proper. All that was put in on the 7th of March. Do you know the next day the bank came in on its own volition and dropped and dismissed the case? Never given us notice, didn't give my clients notice, didn't give me notice, but they dropped the case. And we had a hearing on the 13th of April, Friday the 13th. And this is what we discovered. I walked into the courtroom and went up to the clerk to ask her a question about, okay, when what's going on, if the case is going to be called today, because that's what you typically do in cases like that. So she explained to me, no, the case wasn't going to be called. I said, well, how's that? Because I have it right here in my paperwork that you guys are supposed to call this case. Well, she says, no, it was dismissed. I said, when did this occur? She looked it up in the system and explained to me, yeah, the bank came in and dismissed the case by themselves on their own volition. I said, okay, fine. So I went to go get a printout, and sure enough, this was the case. And the attorney, I spoke to him briefly. He had no explanation for it other than that the office tells them which cases to drop, and that's probably what occurred in that case. So this
well,
is pretty
on,
much
hold
a victory.
Hold on. Now, let's stop right here and hold that right there. But now,
all right, brother.
We got brothers and sisters out there right now that are listening to this broadcast. If they're not listening now, they will be listening in the future.
and they have these problems and cases and stuff that you may be able to assist them with your resource and stuff. Is there any way that they'll be able to contact you, or do you have a website, or is there a number that you can give them to provide them with some type of assistance?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. There's, as a matter of fact, there most certainly is. I'll give you my phone number first and foremost. Again, my name is Sheik L. Love Ill, or you can just call me Brother Love Ill. That's cool. I can be reached at area code 773-699-5905. Again, that's area code 773-699-5905. And I'm a foreclosure specialist. We also deal with asset protection, and that can involve conveying documents like quick claim deeds, things of that nature to protect your house. Oh, also, I can be contacted via email. That one, that's, you just do Moorish Home Office. It's one word, MoorishHomeOffice@gmail.com. MoorishHomeOffice@gmail.com. That's the best way to reach me online. Also, you can type in Sheik Love Ill on Facebook if you want to get a, you know, picture of who you're talking to. That would be me, Sheik Love Ill. And so it's, if you feel free to contact me, I can help you if you're not within my vicinity as well. It's pretty much the same thing all the way across the board. Islam?
Islam, bro. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a brother that's come in. Actually, I spoke to the brother last night. And he agreed to come on to the broadcast with us and drop this information. And we're trying to put the truth and the facts and the power before the people so that we can have a remedy and to do something. And we are quite fortunate at this point to have a medium whereby we can dispense information to our people. So I'm greatly appreciate the brother for coming on. And okay, brother, now if you would go ahead and continue, and then a few moments I'm going to go in and bring in the next plug, but go ahead and finish what you were telling us now.
Okay, Islam, brother. Okay, so just to explain everything, it's pretty much the foreclosure issue. It's pretty much related to the state issue as well, because again, they make a reference to all capital letters on your documentation, and we already understand that that's not really you who you are. And so this is one of the biggest frauds and schemes of all time, believe it or not. So, and at any rate, we have different strategies that we have utilized to create entities for the purpose of helping people to save their homes and helping people to save their homes and things of that nature. Also, to protect the assets.
Okay.
But the main thing we want to do is law.
Okay.
The main thing we want to do is we want to impress the fact that it is important that we understand the importance of proclaiming our nationality as well and studying the process of Nobhadra Ali, because definitely if I had to give credit to where credit is due, I would have to say that himself, along with the forerunner Marcus Garvey, has been most instrumental in bringing me along where I need to be as far as my understanding of things from an economic perspective. So I'm very appreciative of that. And I noticed something, that this is not something that's really hinted on or really dealt with within the public school system per se. So it's always one of those things where you want to go where they don't want you to go. You want to focus on what they don't want you to focus on. So that's what led me to my understanding of where I'm at in my life right now.
Okay. Well, you have to be correct about that.
With that being said, brother, if the brother is back, you know, definitely take over.
I'm here.
Yes, sir.
I'm here. Okay, well, yeah, go ahead.
So, yeah, like I was saying, it's the most fortuitous time because this information had not been really made available to us until a certain time. I mean, if you notice, you know, the housing boom, it came soon after the housing boom came. When I got into the real estate field, you know, there was, we heard a lot about flipping houses and, you know, investment properties and different, there was always somebody trying to, there was always somebody trying to make a quick buck off of real estate. And, you know, sometimes you had brokers that had this special people that they would work with and they would hook up. And,
right.
you know, these people would get listings and sales, and you'd be wondering, well, how? And a lot of times properties would come on the market. They wouldn't even make it on the market before they're sold. So
right.
you'd be thinking that, you know, you it's a fair and open market. No, it doesn't work like that. These properties are already gone. You know, the banks get them, and usually they use underhanded tactics to get access to these properties. I mean, there's nothing beneath them. They will hook and crook you any way they can. They have done it to me, I'm telling you. I remember coming to court on one occasion, and we actually were there to stand for a foreclosure case. And the bank, the attorney for the bank, they ran out, turned tail or something. And the court was in on this. They explained to us that they wouldn't call the case that day. Guess what? They ended up calling that case the same day, but in the afternoon after we had left. So this is what they did in Cook County, Circuit Court, downtown. Now, you would think, oh, you know, I'm okay then. I'm in court. These people have integrity. He's sitting high up on that bench, and, yeah, he's going to be fair. He's going to be fair about it. But no, that wasn't the case. These people get paid. They get kickbacks for turning over so many, for turning so many foreclosures in. Okay, these people are in bed with the banks, and the attorneys too. These people go out to golf together. They play sports. They have relationships that you wouldn't dream or imagine. I mean, how would you know? You're a homeowner coming in, struggling to make your payments, and the attorney is coming in. On the other side, you're probably hiring an attorney and the judge. And all three of these guys know each other. All three of these guys lunch. All three of these guys go to social events together, and they all getting paid at your expense.
Well, you know,
the Bible say, yes, sir.
You know, they are all members of the same club. They are all members of the bar.
That's right.
That's Foreign
Bridge
Corporation.
That's
well,
right.
Brother,
they
what
all part of the same
now,
club.
We have to go into the next segment, and then
yes,
we're
sir.
Going in for the grand finale because we finna deal with the child support thing, and we finna examine that. And I'm gonna go ahead on in there. And but if you would hang on the line, if you got time, and after we're done, then you can give us that information one more time on how to get in touch with you, okay?
Yes, sir, brother.
Okay, I'm back. And a lot of you have been calling me and emailing me, asking me how is it that my counterclaim applies to a criminal case when it's basically a civil action, okay? Now, before I go any further, I have to do a little disclaimer here. This is not legal advice. Everything I say is just my opinion. Everything I play, because I will be playing some audio, is also opinion of others. Okay, and not legal advice. If you want legal advice, go get yourself a competent attorney. Now that that's been said, I'm going to play an audio in a minute, but see, the counterclaim basically challenges jurisdiction. Okay? And in my opinion, I'm always going to win when there is no victim, okay? You see, they want to start making all these rules and regulations and have to follow their policies, but I do not work for the state and I do not work for the city of Glendale. So how can their policies apply to me? Well, they don't, okay? It's like if you work at a job and you have to follow their rules, well, why is it that a customer can do things that you can't? Because those rules don't apply to them. They apply to the people that work for that business or corporation, which is what the city of Glendale is, a corporation. Thank you very much. But let me play something right here, okay? And it might shed some light as to why it applies to a criminal case.
And here's my very simplistic answer. For the last 10 years, we have used the the rules. I never, almost never look at the law because in my belief system, basically the law is irrelevant. I'm looking at the rules. Years ago, in a criminal case up in Seattle, a fellow was in jail and waiting extradition to Texas. And he and his wife both on a charge of running a gifting program. And he was in jail in Washington State on a traffic violation that was a year old, driving without a license, driving while suspended, and driving without insurance. And for some reason, we were allowed to go into the jail cell and meet with him, where I handed him what we termed then an affidavit of specific negative impairment done in Rule 9A of the Rules of Civil Procedure, and this is in a criminal matter. Now, I told him exactly what to do, and he did exactly what he was told. And 45 minutes of the judge literally leaning over the bench, shaking his fist, screaming, throwing his glasses across the room, and finally collapsing in his chair exhausted, he said that he was going to hold the matter over for another week and they would try it again later. The following week, that case was completely gone. And when that man was finally extradited, he and his wife, to Texas 3 weeks later, as they got on the bus to be taken to Texas, a person representing the governor of the state of Washington handed the man and his wife a pardon for the last 12 and a half years for anything they may have done, and their names were expunged from all the records in the state of Washington. And that was done with two pieces of paper. So I have always simply used the rules, and I've asked attorney after attorney after attorney that has come into my life, if I can get a case dismissed with two pieces of paper, why can't you? And of course their answer is, well I don't know what you're doing, and I don't know how that works. But the bottom line is, if they could get the case dismissed with two pieces of paper, they wouldn't make any money. And so I look at this from a very simple, because I'm a simple guy, I don't know the law, I don't care to know the law, I don't study the law. The rules are laid out step by step by step in a very efficient procedural manner. And if you just use and apply the rules, you can defeat just about every case out there.
Okay, so Sam, and, are you saying that in the rules of court somewhere, the rules of procedure somewhere, that a corporation cannot sue a person?
No. Anybody can sue anybody. That's not the issue. The issue is, can they have standing? Can they maintain the suit? And with the moment you address the merits of the suit, you lose.
Okay, so you're saying that a corporation doesn't have standing to sue a person?
Only if they have proof of claim.
Okay.
Only if they have a proof of a claim, an actual contract that has been breached, that they can prove. Now, in this dissertation that we got over the weekend, the judge is actually saying that an affidavit from and he used the example of MERS, who is the servicing agent for millions of mortgages. He said an affidavit from an agent at MERS who looks at a couple screenshots and then makes an affidavit is wholly inadequate to create standing and wholly inadequate to make a proof of claim. Well, that means that every credit card case that's ever been sued can be unwound and undone on a 60B motion, a void judgment, and here's the reason why it's void. There was no proof of claim. And I am solely 100% in the rules here. And I just use them back and forth. And this rule goes right along hand in hand with everything in my belief system.
Well,
I very much like this approach because it's, I don't know how to say it, it's so different than what way I normally think. I think in terms of statute.
Well,
and if something seems intuitively right about paying as much, if not a whole lot more attention to the rules than the statute.
Well, it's certainly, you know, Randy, with all the techniques that you have perfected and that, you know, what we've come up with together, you and me, I mean, certainly applying some of these tactics would just make what we do all that much more powerful.
Well, look, the Hartford Van Dyke 10 years ago told me, Sam, every case fails at its first defect. Every case fails at its first defect. Find the first defect, attack it, and never leave it. And you will win every time.
That's pretty much what Randy does with due process.
Okay. And due process, this goes right to the heart of due process. This is due process. Who is the real party in interest? Who are you and what is this?
And you're just asking them to prove up and they can't do it, right?
That's exactly correct.
The issue I keep coming back to is in criminal prosecutions, does the federal government or the executive branch of the federal government have standing by statute like they do in Texas?
Well, can I address that?
Yes.
Okay? There's no such thing as a criminal statute until you stand under, and the judge uses that term, understand the charges against you. Every case brought is brought in commerce, and every case brought is civil until you cross the line on the sheet on the front sheet of the paper where you see the court caption and heading. When you cross those little parentheses over there to the charge.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you once again, we're back to the same thing. Contract law, operating in commerce, the first infraction or the first ill thing that went wrong is a fraud. It's in capital letters, simple as you. Go ahead and hit that thing. And keep on going, man. Look, just contact me. Area code 904-303-9061. And we'll get you into Hawkins Library. Go ahead and put that thing up under your belt. And go on and get your baseball bat and start swinging. And win some of these things. We're going directly into the next segment. And we're going to our child
support. In order to extract welfare reimbursement from poor families, the state of Georgia uses aggressive child support recovery tactics that send many indigent parents to jail. For families who have received welfare, a substantial amount of the child support collected does not go to the children, but directly to the state. The city of Adel is a town of a little over 5,000 people located in Cook County, Georgia, 4 hours south of Atlanta. The latest U.S. Census data finds that a staggering 24% of families in Adel live below the poverty line. In late 2009, the Southern Center for Human Rights discovered how poverty and poor economic climate was affecting parents trying to pay child support. Senior Attorney Sarah Garrity.
We received a letter from a group of women at the jail, and the letter stated that people were being jailed indefinitely for their inability to pay child support. And when we went and visited the jail, we found that fully a third of the people who were incarcerated there were in fact there for inability to pay child support.
That one-third was comprised of 32 men and 13 women who contributed to the overcrowding of the jail and cost taxpayers $35 per person per day to house. Many of the parents incarcerated were too poor to afford an attorney. They were not provided an attorney by the court and were denied their right to a hearing that would determine whether their failure to pay child support was in fact willful.
When they locked me up, that was my first time ever being locked up for child support. That was my first time ever being behind for child support. But he didn't show me no kind of leniency. He just went ahead and told me to make sure I have my toothbrush when I come to see him the next month. And I think that's wrong.
The next month, Mr. McBurrows was incarcerated. He would serve 91 days before his release. Katrina Brown's children were in the custody of her mother while Katrina escaped a drug addiction and an abusive marriage. She moved back in with her mother and children, got on her feet, and was then sued by the state for public benefits received by her children while in her mother's custody.
When I first got locked up, at that time, just literally, it was like, it was no questions asked. Just lock her up.
She was incarcerated multiple times for being too poor to pay. She was last imprisoned for 11 and a half months. Because there was no visitation at the jail, her children were not allowed to see her. While in jail, child support payments continued to accrue with interest, driving already indigent parents further into debt. James Pickett was once heralded as Father of the Year, a consistent payment of child support and a great dad. After almost 4 years at Chaparral Boats, he was laid off. He then took a lower wage job at the Adel Auto Wash. When the auto wash closed down, he was unable to find employment.
I took care of my kids always. I raised them. I raised them, treated them wrong to me. You know, but now that I'm out of a job right now, it's, you know, just makes the whole.
Working parents who are paying child support frequently lose over 60% of their paycheck to the state. If the court is not satisfied with the money they are able to submit, they can be found in contempt and jailed.
When I got released, I got a job at McDonald's, and I really wasn't making enough to pay to meet child support requirements. I went from there to Piggly Wiggly, and I started working there, making $7.25 an hour. My first check at Piggly Wiggly, I brought home like $500. After child support took out, my check was like $163. And by the time I got to the house to give my mom or whatnot bill, I don't have no money to do nothing to take care of my kids or to pay bills to meet my needs, my personal needs.
One time I went to court, I told them I had the money to pay on my child support, but I had rent, light, and my children need something to eat, and that one, they told me that one they concerned. Every time you go to the court, 9 out of 10, you're going to get locked up if you ain't got the money or a job.
The case most telling of the failures of the child support system is that of Mr. Frank Hatley.
Mr. Hatley had been jailed in Adel, Georgia, for about a year and a half because he failed to pay child support, even though Mr. Hatley does not, in fact, have any children.
In 2000, Judge Dane Perkins and the Assistant Attorney General presiding over child support hearings were given conclusive DNA evidence that Mr. Hatley was not the father of the child in question.
I was just labeled as a deadbeat dad, and they was going to get that money out of me regardless, even though they know that DNA test had proved that wasn't my child. But by me not having to afford a real lawyer, I couldn't win because I couldn't afford a real lawyer to represent me. So they kept just abusing me and abusing me. You better pay this and you better pay that. And I didn't have no rights.
After he lost his job and became homeless living out of his car, Mr. Hatley continued to pay with his unemployment check. Despite his efforts and the DNA evidence, Judge Perkins and the Assistant Attorney General reincarcerated Mr. Hatley. This time he served 13 months.
One day seemed like 1,000 years. You just know, you just don't know when you're going to get out. Don't know when you're going to court. Your life is a total mess when you're locked up for child support. My life still messed up. Because you can't get back that time.
The Southern
19 years old, then I decided it would be best for my wife and myself and my daughter, who was on the way, for me to go in the Army. I served for 3 years and 3 months. I was making $3,500 a month. I was in Germany, and turns out she called me up one day and told me she had cheated on me. So I got divorced, and the child support started. They set my child support payment rate to $400 a month. When I got back, I started working and trying to find every job I could, and I started to fall back behind on my payments because I wasn't making enough and I wasn't employed long enough.
In theory, debtors' prisons are legal in this country, but in reality, they exist right here in Georgia. The law says that before a judge can put someone in jail for failure to pay a debt, there has to be a judicial finding that that person's failure to pay was willful. Anytime that we are talking about depriving someone of his or her liberty, we really have to make sure that the process that we use to get to that result is fair.
I had a warrant out for me after the first month. I was arrested and I went to jail, and they asked me all sorts of questions. I was never told I was under arrest. I was placed in handcuffs, and I was never read my rights. So I did not know what rights I had in complete. Of course, I've seen all these movies, but half that isn't true.
Well, I think the Georgia laws are broken. I mean, they're good intentions to help the children, but, you know, you've got a 24-year-old son that still has to live at home because he can't get enough work to pay his child support. And when he went to court, the judge asked him if he'd been looking for work, but he'd been locked up for 4 months. How's he supposed to look for work? And this is what the judge told him. And I got a little upset in the courtroom. I said, you know, that's ridiculous. That just makes no sense at all. How's a person supposed to look for work when they're sitting in the jail? And then you get free labor out of them, so the county doesn't pay for it. Nobody's getting anything but further in debt.
I'm not running from my responsibilities. It's the exact opposite. My daughter's about to be 5 years old, and honestly, I love her to death, and I'd do anything for her.
Watch your fingers. You don't want to get bit.
She currently lives with a mother, and I get joint custody, which I get to see her every other weekend. I'm trying to give her everything I can. Even though I can't make the payments, I try to do everything over here for her.
In many instances, jailing an indigent parent for his inability to pay child support is entirely counterproductive. Because a parent can't work and pay child support while he's confined to the jail. So it impedes that parent's economic prospects. But perhaps more importantly, placing a parent in jail separates the parent from child.
I hope with working in the fields, I'll be able to pay my child support. I don't even keep money for a place to stay. We get paid by the truck, so the longer it takes us, the less money we earn. The state, instead of locking people up, should give people jobs or attempt to find them, because a lot of people can't find jobs. If somebody can't do the job and doesn't want to do the job, then they should be the ones going to jail, not the people who are willing to.
Good day, this is George McCaslin, coming to you from my home at the Indian Meadows Nursing Center. I am the online moderator for the Dad's House Educational Group, found at the above address, as well as on Facebook. Today we will be reviewing the article on contempt of court for non-support from the child support chapter of the Dad's House Educational Manual. At the end of this video, you will see a list of other videos on child support, as well as material that is available in the Dad's House Manual. Remember, we are not here to solve your problems. We are here to teach you how to solve them yourself through knowledge, for with knowledge comes power, and with the power of knowledge comes rights. Also, please consider rating this video, as well as sharing it to your Facebook and Twitter pages.
tried enduring a contempt of court hearing for child support. The company I work for laid off over 2,000 people over a year ago. I have tried to find a job, but there are just too many people out of work in my state. I paid as much of my child support as I could from my unemployment, but I needed money for gas to look for work as well as eat. I could not afford an attorney to get my support reduced, and the clerk of the court said they could not help me. Now companies are hiring, saying they're asked that if you are unemployed, you need not apply. They will only hire those who already have a job. I saw the report on it in the news. Apparently, some politicians are trying to make it illegal. I can't leave the state to look for work. Aside from it taking me away from my children, child support says I can't move due to how much I owe. My child's mother wants all the money, so now I've been served with papers to go to court to face contempt charges for not making my whole payment. What do I do now?
In today's man session, with over 80% of all layoffs involving men, this has created a massive difficulty for those ordered to pay child support. Added to this difficulty, the states do not inform child support obligors at the time the order was established. They in the event of a loss of income, such as a result of a job loss, that help is available from the state to modify a child support order. What is contempt of court? Stephen H. Griffiths, in his book Law Dictionary, defines contempt of court as an act or omission tending to obstruct or interfere with the orderly administration of justice, or to impair the dignity of the court or respect for its authority. There are two kinds, direct and constructive. Direct contempt openly and in the presence of the court resists the power of the court. Constructive contempt results from matters outside the court, such as failure to comply with orders. Another classification differentiates between civil and criminal contempt. Civil contempt consists of failure to do something which is ordered by the court for the benefit of another party to the proceedings, sometimes called relief to litigants, while criminal contempt are acts in disrespect of the courts or its processes which obstruct the administration of justice. The penalty for civil contempt is usually payment of a fine or imprisonment for an indefinite period of time until the party in contempt agrees to perform his legal obligation, unless the imprisonment clearly fails to act as coercion and merely to punish. The penalty for criminal contempt is a fine or imprisonment for a specified period of time, intended as punishment which must be tried by jury if post-conviction contempt proceedings impose sentences exceeding an aggregate of 6 months. What to do? The lack of knowledge about what help is available has led to increasing numbers of child support obligors accumulating arrears, leaving them open to being summoned before the court in a contempt of court citation. The following explains what can be done in addressing this issue. If you go to court without an attorney when the court asks if you are ready, it is prudent for you to answer no, and that you do not have an attorney and cannot afford an attorney. If asked further, hold your ground. In recent appellate decisions, it has been ruled that indigents are entitled to court-appointed attorneys when the outcome of a ruling would result in incarceration, i.e. jail time. Sometimes the courts can be tricky and intimidating in their questions. Hold your ground, but come prepared with written evidence. If you are behind due to previous unemployment, you must be prepared to present these items. Records of your filing for or receipt unemployment compensation. A detailed paper trail of evidence showing why you were released from your employment, of other situation resulting in the loss of income, and what efforts you are making to find a new job and or obtain career retraining. You should also be maintaining a record of your ongoing efforts in your daily journal. When on the stand, you may have this with you in order to refer to when answering questions. If you cannot make a valid argument for why you are in arrears, you need to have developed a game plan to repay the arrears. Also, go through the same steps of not being able to borrow money or sell non-essentials for cash. Remember, it costs the county over $100 per day to house in civil contempt in the county jail. If you have a game plan to repay the arrears, and can show a common sense reason for the back child support, most courts will not put a father in jail, even if they find him in contempt. If found in contempt, they will usually substitute probation for a period of time, and this will be dependent upon the game plan adopted by the court on making up the arrears. at the minimum. This will involve making a full child support payment, plus an addition one-half payment to go toward the arrears. If probation is violated, it means, do not pass go, do not collect $200, and go directly to jail. Note, if there is a potential issue of bias, remember that you can request a change of venue to a different judge or county. However, you should always take people with you to court who are not there to testify, but to act as court watchers, to monitor and maintain their own written record of the hearing. At this link, there is a court watch form designed for this purpose. If the judge is being unbalanced in his or her view of your case, using the info from this form, you can appeal and or get the judge sanctioned and removed from the case. You file complaints with the state Supreme Court at your state capital.
This is George again. If a father is unemployed and actively looking for work, and if that father is imprisoned on contempt of court for non-payment of child support, then the sentencing judge has done nothing to alleviate the father's inability to pay. Instead, the judge has aggravated the situation by denying the father the ability to seek employment. If the judge is not a part of the solution, he is a part of the problem. Thank you. That concludes a review of this article from the Dad's House Manual. When using the manual, please consider clicking on the Facebook and Twitter links at the top to share this material with those in your social network. There are over 40 million divorced and single fathers in America, most of whom are searching around for help in the issues found in this manual. Also, fathers are a frequent target of the media and politicians inciting what they think is wrong with America. They blame us for fatherless children, even though 40% of divorced single mothers deny fathers access to their children. They call us deadbeat dads, even though only 3% of those ordered to pay child support flatly refuse to do so. They claim that millions of single mothers are not getting child support, without mentioning that 75% of single mothers never applied for any, either due to them cohabiting with the father or not knowing who the father is. If we are to curb the negative picture presented about fathers, then fathers need to be expressing their opinions on it. You can be doing that by writing letters to your politicians and to the editorial page of local and national newspapers. These links will teach you how to do just that. Consider doing it at least once a month. We cannot make our voices heard if we are not willing to speak up. Consider checking out the Zazu stores for Dad's House and Second Wife Club for items to give as gifts or to express your opinion on father's rights. First, we have the main Dad's House store with items of appreciation for father. From there, we have the Second Wife Club, also for items of appreciation that you would want to give to a stepmother. Then we have the Father's Rights page, which are items for expressing one's opinion on the father's rights.
Okay, Mose. Now, I want you to notice something very, very interesting when it comes to attorneys attempting to tell you how to remedy a situation. They mention things like how to go about paying and if you're in the errage, how to handle a situation and all that. And the reason all of this information comes from attorneys is because they are included in the process. They are including themselves in the process to be able to get paid, just like you would go to a hospital. You are sick. When you get to the hospital, what you are looking for is a cure. But what the hospital is going to do is they are going to treat you because there is no money for them in a cure. If they cure everybody that comes to the hospital, there will be no need for hospitals because there will be no patients. Everybody will be cured. So what we will have to do is we are going to have to string along the situation. We're going to treat you for diabetes, which could be cured in 30 days. We're going to treat you for high blood pressure medicine, which can be cured. We're going to treat you for this. We're going to treat you for that. But when you go looking for a remedy, you're looking for a cure. So what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with the solutions and we're dealing with the cures.
Now, we only have 10 minutes more, and I'm going to open up this line and ask this brother and sister if you'll be very brief.
Yeah.
Area code 260, could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your comment or question?
Islam, this is Noble Muaydi Ben Burgos L. I'm from Great Seal National Association of Moorish Affairs. I'm calling from area code 260 here in the Garden of Eden, or what you call Fort Wayne, Indiana. Also, I wanted to add to that child support, you have Ex Parte Davis, which says it is illegal. You cannot take a civil matter and convert it into a criminal matter and lock somebody up for child support. It is illegal and it's a constitutional violation. Ex Parte Davis. You cannot lock somebody up for child support. It is illegal. It is case law, Ex Parte Davis. And also, when you go purchase a home, when they close it, the home is paid for on closing. They access your SETI Q Trust or that red number on the back of your Social Security card, and the house is paid for in full, and the bank turns around and defrauds you and make you pay for it twice. So that's another reason how you could keep your foreclosures. It's already paid for on closing. But they don't want you to know that.
Well, now what they told me was sitting right in here to my dining room table. They told me that well, it looks like everything's fine. The only thing we need is the bank has agreed to give you the loan, and all you got to do is go to the bank, and they're going to give you the loan. And when I got to the bank, I filed a whole lot of paperwork, and the bank considered everything done and all of this business here. But I never received a check.
Exactly. You got to remember, what does mortgage mean? Mort in Latin means dead. Gage means pledge. It's a dead pledge. It's paid for on closing off of your SETI Q Trust Securities Trust Fund that you supposed to have privatized when you were 18 years old. It's paid for in full. It's a dead pledge. Mortgage. Mort, dead, gauge, pledge, dead pledge, period.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this right here. In regards to the child support situation, in your opinion, brother, and keep in mind we only have a few moments left, and I got to get my other brother to come back in so we can get some information how to get in touch with him. But those brothers who have right now that got their foot in the stirrup right now, in your opinion, what should they start doing right now to remedy this situation?
Well, like you said earlier, you're not being charged. You're being sued. It's a counterclaim. You counterclaim and use Ex Parte Davis. Ex Parte Davis is very thorough. And it says explicitly you cannot be locked up for child support, period. It is very thorough. Ex Parte Davis. Everybody listening, look it up. This is real, my Kansu brother, Noble Abdul McDonald Bay. He found that himself, and he's in the process of using it as we speak. And also, what was I about to say? Something I lost my train of thought here for a second. But basically, back to the foreclosures, that's a dead pledge. It's already paid for on closing, but they don't want you to know that. Because as soon as it's closed, they sell it. And then it turns around and gets sold again, and then it gets sold again, and it gets sold again. That's why they can't find none of those original documents. That's another reason, because they sell it as soon as it's closed, because the house is paid for in full off of your personal account, your SETI Q Trust, Securities Trust Fund. You heard Obama last July talking about he was selling securities. Those were us he was selling.
Okay.
He was selling.
Well, brother,
the
I tell you what
trust.
Now. Over here at my house, my mom's coming. They have amazed me. It is amazing because they are, when it comes to me, Lord, I just grind them up. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to the close of the broadcast. I do not have enough time to open up the line to my brother again so he can give us that information. But it's already in the broadcast. What I'm going to ask you to do, if you'd be kind enough to re-listen to the broadcast, keep your paper and pencil in your hand so you can get this information down and you'll be able to contact the brother. And you, sir, I appreciate you calling in. I'm going to mute the mic and going out with this thing. Now, don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, one more time, just go ahead and contact me to Hawk Armando LB, area code 904-303-9061, and we get you in that library. And also on the 19th and 20th, Brother Booker T. Coleman will be right here in Jacksonville, Florida, and he will be teaching. So if you're down here, you'll get a teaching of the lifetime, okay? And I'm sorry that the time has expired. We've expounded a whole lot of information, so I'm asking if you listen to this over and over and over again. Those of you who are on Facebook, go ahead and send us your Facebook requests. You can hit me up at Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and we'll go ahead and grant your Facebook request. Also, send me your request. Just send an email to me. Tahaka, just send me your 14th Amendment exposed in the commerce game, and I'll send that to you as an email attachment. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, Divine Minister for the Moorish American National Government, and ladies and gentlemen, until next time.
wanna do.